So, right, we basically split Perek Dalet into two. Last week, we focused on the disaster of the battle that B'nai Israel fight with the Plishtim at Afek. I think last week I was calling it Ofek, but it's Afek. Right, which, you know, was two different battles. They fought one day, then they lost. They bring the Aron Kodesh. We saw B'nai Israel have the same basic pagan mentality as the Plishtim do, that they'll bring the Aron, and either the Aron will save them or the Aron will force Hashem to save them. And the Plishtim also thought of the Aron as like some, you know, God incarnate. Doesn't work, right? The second battle is even worse. It ends up in a catastrophe. B'nai Israel, instead of going back to the camp, just run to their homes. And that is where we left off, right? We learned the battle last week. This week, we'll focus on the aftermath of the battle. But just one point to reflect is that there was a very strong parallel between the battle last week that B'nai Israel fight at Afek and the previous major battle that we had in Tanakh, right? Which we learned together back in the day. The last major battle that we have in Tanakh was the civil war between all of the tribes of B'nai Israel and the tribe of Binyamin, right? When B'nai Israel were horrified by the conduct of the Anshei Binyamin who lived in the city of Giva, and that led to civil war and essentially the genocide of Binyamin, very strong parallels to this battle, right? These are two battles where the Navi emphasizes all of B'nai Israel are united in the battle. You know, in Sefer Shoftim, the battles almost all are always are only undertaken by some of the tribes. The battle of Pelegesh, the battle of Giva, with Binyamin, is unique in that it's all of Klal Yisrael come to fight. Once again, now we have the entire nation going to war. Both times we have multiple battles. B'nai Israel, they drastically outnumber Binyamin, and they're confident that they're going to win, but they lost, right? And then they regroup, and they think what they could do differently, and then they lose again. Same phenomenon happens here when B'nai Israel are fighting the Plishtim. They lose a battle, right? And they go back that night. They think, what exactly should they do? And then they go back to fight the next day. And just like the battle with Binyamin, where B'nai Israel, they lose the first battle, then they go back, they think, what should we do? They don't do tshuva, and then they go back and they lose again. So that happens here as well, right? They go back to their camp after they lose the first battle. Instead of saying, you know, we have to do tshuva, we have to improve our ways, we have to daven, they say, okay, we'll bring the Aron Kodesh, and that's going to solve all of our problems. So I think it's clear that, you know, that is something that we're supposed to have in mind. The failures of Sefer Shoftim, and the greatest failure of Sefer Shoftim, the end, right, the battle of Giva, is now coming full circle. Because now, of course, it's not a civil war with Binyamin. Now all of B'nai Israel is united against a real enemy, but they haven't learned any of the lessons. There has been no growth from the end of Shoftim until now. The religious nadir that the people were in then, they are still in now. You see them running the exact same playbook, and they're getting the exact same results, which is total destruction and devastation. Right? They've had 40 years of Eli's tenure to grow. That has not happened, and we see the results clearly in front of us. And as we'll see, as we learn some of the aftermath, we'll see why I think it's important to keep this the legacy of this battle in mind. And it's going to be a battle which really is going to haunt B'nai Israel throughout Sefer Shmuel. I apologize. It really was like a transformative moment. Why can't I? Here we go. So let me just share this guy, and then we'll look at some of the sources. One second, I apologize. Share screen. Yeah. No, it's not what. Okay. Is it up on the screen now? It was a little weird before. We're good? Okay, Baruch Hashem. Great. We ended off last week. The battle is over. Bnei Yisrael are defeated. The Aron's been captured. The sons of Eli have been killed on the battlefield. We have Pasuk Yud Beis. Vayaretz ish Binyamin mehamaracha. A man of Binyamin fled from the battle. Vayavoshi lo bayom hahu. He made it to Shiloh on that day. Pasuk makes it sound like a big deal that this man from Binyamin gets to Shiloh on that day. Reason is, I think Dat Mikra does a calculation from where they think the city of Afek is to where Shiloh is. In a straight line, they said it's like 35 kilometers. So when you consider how far he had to run, and assuming he had to zigzag, you know, the legendary Battle of Marathon, where the Greek runner ran 26.2 miles, it seems like the Ish Binyamin has to run a similar distance, right? He's going all the way. Remember where the Battle of Afek was? Remember the map, right? It was on the border between the Shfela and the coast, right? Where you begin to get into the hill country, and the Plishtim are trying to invade and break through. So he has to run all the way from there to Shiloh, which is in the middle of Har Ephraim, in the core and the spine of the country. So he gets all the way there. Umadav kruim ve'adama al roshav. His clothes are torn, and there is dirt upon his head. Right? He's in mourning. He's in mourning because he was at the battle. They lost. Right? He's just seen 30,000 of his fellow soldiers killed, and he's running back to Shiloh, which is, you know, the Jewish central location, to relate the bad news. Now, Rashi has a comment on this, classic comment from Rashi, and I think it's worth spending a few minutes unpacking it, because, you know, I titled the shiur for today, the Fall of Eli, the Rise of Binyamin, because while, you know, when you first go through the text, so the clear aspect of the end of the battle is the final collapse of Eli and his whole household. I think it's very important. At the same time, there is a second undercurrent here. Rashi comments, Ish Binyamin, right? There's a man from Binyamin who flees the battle, says Rashi, Zehaya Shaul. This was Shaul, right? We've not seen before, but he's coming up Parak in a few prakim. He's gonna make an appearance, first king of Israel. Shechataf esaluchos miad Golyasu Baruchlo. He grabbed the luchos from Golyas, right? So we're putting Golyas in the story. We're putting Shaul in the story, right? Ubaruchlo, right? Who else other than Golyas would capture the Aron Kodesh and murder Chafni and Pinchas, the sons of Eli? And so you have this, like, this visual of Golyas. You know, you can imagine Chafi and Pinchas are dead. Golyas kills him, right? And, like, he bends down to pick up, you know, the Aron Kodesh, and he wants to, like, take out the Luchos. You know, little Shaul, relatively, runs up to Golyas, right, grabs the Luchos, and runs back with them to Shiloh. Very interesting. Where is Rashi getting any of this from, right? Other than, you know, as they say, the methodology of the conservation of biblical characters, right? That you like, you know, when if there's an anonymous person someplace in Tanakh, so, you know, you'll try to fill them in with someone else we know. But why is Rashi, what is Rashi adding to the story? Where is this coming from that Shaul is the person involved, that Shaul is the fugitive? I think we can see, actually, Rashi is getting at a very important point, right? There's a reason why Rashi's saying this. And Rashi is not saying, you know, Zehu Midrasho. Rashi does comments as if this is the pshat and the pasuk. So what are the connections between Shaul and this soldier who is fleeing and running from the battle? So, you know, a couple, first, just the Malbim, the Malbim makes a point that it's noteworthy that, you know, Bnei Yisrael had a large army, right? But only one person actually runs all the way back to Shiloh, right? Says the Malbim, what happened? Well, the Pasuk had said that the Bnei Yisrael all ran back to their tents. So says the Malbim, everyone flees the battle. Everyone runs away from the battle, and they all flee. Everyone tries to lie low, right? He says, "Hit pazru b'chol pina." You can imagine the aftermath of a devastating military defeat. They're hiding in caves, right? They lost the battle. You know, the Plishtim are on a rampage. They're probably killing any soldier they find. So everyone is just trying to find somewhere to lie low, which is going to be behavior we're going to see from Bnei Yisrael in a few prakim. The next time they fight against the Plishtim, we'll see them hiding out in caves. He says, "Rak Ishechad Rat." There's only one. There's only one person who had the courage to run to Shiloh, where, by the way, he knows that that is where the Plishtim are going to march, right? Because the Plishtim are going to destroy the Mishkan of Shiloh. It's not said explicitly in Shmuel Aleph, but it's referenced elsewhere in Tanakh. We saw in Tehillim last week. He knows, right? As soon as they win the battle, they're going to march on the Jewish capital. So instead of going to where the Plishtim are not going to be, this Ish Binyamin takes it upon himself to remain in the line of danger and run to the town and warn them what is about to happen. Right. So we establish, he's running a long way. It's a heroic act. But where is Shaul coming from? And I think we can identify a few points. And we'll see why this is important. So the first and probably most obvious is that the Navi had described an Ish Binyamin, right? A man from Binyamin. Now, in general, when Tanakh introduces someone as an Ish, so that means that they're not like some Tom, Dick, and Harry, right? That means it's a person of particular stature. We saw this in the very first year we did on Pasal Micha, where the Navi said it sarcastically about that Levi, you remember the Levi who at the same time was a Na'ar and an Ish, right? And it's because, he was a grandson of Moshe, so he had impressive Yichus. He was an important person, even though, he personally was like a zero. We had it at the beginning of Sefer Shmuel, the Ish who was Elkanah, right? Very important person. So we have it's not just any person from Binyamin, it's an important person from Binyamin. And when we get to Perek Tes, this line of Ish mi Binyamin is used again and again in the context of Shaul, right? So Shaul is introduced, Vahi Ish mi Binyamin, Ushmo Kish ben Aviel ben Tzur, etc., etc., etc. He had a son who was Shaul, Bachur Batov, in Ish mi Bnei Yisrael Tov Mimenu. Come back to that in a second, right? But Ish, a few psukim later, when Hashem comes to Shmuel and tells him that someone's going to show up to your house, and you're going to anoint him as king. So what does Hashem say to Shmuel? He says, "Heis machar eshlach elecha ish me'eretz Binyamin." Right. Once again, the man from Binyamin. Shmuel sees him, and then Hashem says to Shmuel, "Hineu ish." Right. Here is the man. So when Shaul is introduced, he's consistently referred to as the man from Binyamin, right? That's probably the clearest point indicating that the anonymous Ish mi Binyamin in our parak, who's running away from the battle to bring the news to Shiloh, is actually Shaul, right? And furthermore, how does the Navi describe Shaul? In Ish mi Bnei Yisrael Tov Imenu, right? He's the best man in the army. He's the tallest man. He's the most impressive man. So if we had to imagine who in the Jewish army, the whole nation comes out to fight, well, who's going to be the person who's able to have the courage to stay in the line of duty, right? To go where he needs to go instead of just running home and to accomplish that marathon run? Makes sense that it's Shaul, right? Who's the most physically impressive person in Bnei Yisrael, in Ish mi Bnei Yisrael Tov Mimenu. And he's being referred to as an Ish Binyamin. Okay, so that's like, level one. But what meaning are we supposed to get from that? I think we can find a couple more hints to Shaul in this pasuk, in this Rashi. And let's take a look. So one. Right. It came to the Monday night shiur. We talked about this pasuk. We talked about David and Goliath, right? When Goliath in Perek Yud Zayin is defying Bnei Yisrael, and he marches out from the camp and he says, you know, I'm the Plishti, you know, one of you fight me. Beru lachem ish v'yirid alai. I am the Philistine. You are the servants of Shaul. Choose a man and fight me. Right? Beru lachem ish v'yirid alai. So Rashi comments, there's clearly the pshat in the pasuk. Who does Goliath intend should be the one to fight him? Right? Who really should be the ish who fights Goliath? Shaul. Says Rashi, it should be Shaul. Right? Goliath is the greatest warrior among the Plishtim. Shaul is the greatest warrior among the Jews. Abarbanel thinks that Goliath was the Saran, the tyrant of one of the Plishti cities. So Goliath is a ruler. Shaul is a ruler. It's natural that Shaul should be the one to fight. And that's clearly the shot, right? When Shaul gives David his armor, so it's a very symbolic moment because really, Shaul should be the one fighting, but he doesn't have the courage to go forth. It's not really courage, right? He's a rational person. He doesn't have the faith to go forth, right? If he knows that for him to fight Goliath is suicidal, he just doesn't have the bitachon that David does. So you have, right, in Perek Yud Zayin, a very clear reference. Who is the ish who should fight Goliath? Right? It's Shaul. So this is already Perek Yud Zayin, right? By this point in time, you know, Shaul, there's a lot of baggage that Shaul is carrying, right? He's already been told twice he's being fired from being the king. This is not the young, enthusiastic Shaul that we'll have in Perek Tess and Perek Yud Yud Aleph, right? So when Rashi comments that in our battle, Shaul was the man of Binyamin, right, who runs up to Goliath and grabs a luchos and comes back to Shiloh. So these two Rashis, ours in Perek Dalet and this one in Perek Yud Zayin, are in conversation. And you put them together, what Rashi is saying is that when Shaul begins his career, right, he was the man of courage and vigor and energy who was willing to challenge Goliath, right, in order to protect the luchos and to protect Klal Yisrael. Then by the time we get to Perek Yud Zayin, where Shaul has already begun to fall, there's already been the failure with Amalek and others. So now we see that he no longer has the confidence, right, in challenging the Plishtim. So those two Rashis go together. And I think that there's one more important point. And this one is, you know, on more of an upbeat note. Which is this moment for Bnei Yisrael, and it's so important for us not to lose track of it, right? Because when we think of Sefer Shmuel generally, we think of Shaul and Yehonasan and David and Shmuel, obviously. But it's important to keep in mind that this moment here in Perek Dalet is rock bottom. Right? It does not get worse than it is right now. And we chronicled the line of Bnei Yisrael, and Micha and Pilabesh Plegesh Vegeva and Bnei Eli. Right now, this is rock bottom, right? The Plishtim have maximum conquest. They're going to destroy the Mishkan. Bnei Yisrael have no leadership. The Aron is captured. And so what's critical to tease out is that the moment of rock bottom, what Rashi really is saying is that we see glimmers of hope, right? You know, it's darkest before the dawn, so then that means that the dawn is about to come. And that really is the exact MO of Shevet Binyamin. That is exactly the personality of Binyamin, right? That Binyamin emerges when times are dark. And that's exactly Rashi's bracha about Binyamin. Let's think about this pasuk for a second, right? We'll read this in a couple of weeks when we get to Parshas Vayechi. What does Yaakov say about Binyamin? Binyamin zev yitraf, right? He's a wolf who will tear. Baboker yochal ad ularav yechalek shalal. So he's compared to a wolf, right, who's eating in the morning and dividing spoil in the evening. What is the symbolism of a wolf? Radaxis has a piece, right, which I think is very reminiscent of our Rashi about Shaul running up to Goliath. Says the Radak, what the wolf is willing to do, right, is he is more brazen than other animals. He will run up to the behemoth and the chayot, to abir lev lavo el hayishuv yoser mishar chayot, right? He is willing to approach human civilization, right? Other animals, you know, they're afraid, right? You know, the camps, you know, in the mountains. So during the winter, the bears run all around, right? But the bears are not in the camp during the summer for the most part, unless it's, you know, color war breakout. But a wolf is less afraid of humans, right? The wolf is not as afraid of people who are stronger than he is. So, you know, Radak says that describes Binyamin, right? That they were, you know, mighty warriors. And we think about Binyamin and Shoftim, who are taking on all of Bnei Yisrael. But this exact description really is how Rashi is describing Shaul, isn't it? Running up to the person who is stronger than he is, right? Grabbing the luchos from him and running. That really is just like a wolf, you know, that runs up into town, defies the more powerful people to grab, you know, a lamb to run off with. So that's point one, right? That what Rashi is describing, running up to Goliath and grabbing the luchos, really is quintessential, you know, wolf Binyamin behavior. And then you have Rashi's comment on the pasuk, right? Which is, what does it refer to that Binyamin appears in the morning and the evening? So says Rashi, the morning refers to Shaul, right? The beginning of the light of Israel, and Mordechai and Esther emerge at the close, right? At sunset, when times get dark, the end of, you know, basically the period of the Tanakh. Yehuda, who is compared to a lion. So a lion is a dominant figure, right? Yehuda's moment in the sun is the period from David through the end of Bayis Rishon. But when we get into, you know, what we could call like the Bein Hashmashos of Jewish history, right? The period right before the dawn of David and the period right after the sunset of Tzidkiyahu and the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash. So those are the moments where you need the leadership of the wolf. And that's where Binyamin comes out, right? Yehuda is not leading in Megillas Esther. It's ironic because the Jews are called Yehudim, right? But it's Binyamin which is leading. And Yehuda is not leading here. It is once again Binyamin. So it is Shaul, right? At the moment of darkness, the first sign of the dawn of Tchilat Prichatam is Prichatam Shal Yisrael, is the emergence of Shaul. So then when Rashi, you know, tells us that Shaul is this mysterious man from Binyamin, right, who is running to Shiloh, so what he's saying is, do not just think in terms of gloom and doom. There also is a glimmer of the coming hope, which is going to emerge in the coming second, right? So it's rock bottom. But this comment from Rashi about the man of Binyamin highlights that also, you know, rock bottom also means that we're at a turning point. Okay. So, you know, that said, right, as you know, maybe inspiring and hopeful as that is, right, the bottom line is things are still really bad. So the man from Binyamin gets to Shiloh, and the Navi describes Eli, right, who is Yoshev Alakisei, he's sitting on his chair. Once again, every time we see Eli, he's either sitting or lying down, right? Chana saw Eli and he was sitting down, right? Then we had Shmuel's dream, Eli was lying down. Once again, Eli is sitting, right? And we're told, Yach, which I think some of the Farshim say means that his heart was pounding. Why? Eli Bochare, his heart was trembling. Al Aron Elokim, thanks. This brings back everything from last week, right? The Aron is everything. And where did that mentality, which we saw ultimately became Avodah Zarah, where does it come from? Ultimately, it comes from Eli, right? The Kohen Gadol himself, who's from, he's not a pagan, God forbid, Eli, right? but by placing so much emphasis on the Aron. So we saw last week where that leads to. And that is the mentality of Eli as well. Okay, so the man from Binyamin comes to the town, right? He's telling them the news. Batizak kol ha'ir. You can imagine the city's crying out because they have to run. They know the city's about to be destroyed. The Plishtim are coming. Eli hears, once again, right, the passivity. He hears what's going on, and it's sad. It's pathetic, right? Meh kol ha'hamon ha'zeh. You know, everyone else in town knows what's happening, and he's just asking, you know, what is going on? What is going on? Pasuk Tezvav, we're told Eli is 98 years old, and he's not able to see. Think of Moshe Rabbeinu, the end of Vezos HaBracha, we're told he was 120, right? But Torah said that he didn't lose a step and he didn't lose any of his vision, right? So Eli is, you know, he's the new leader, but it's like the opposite of Moshe, right? He can't move, he's sitting in a chair and he's blind. And by the way, we see the decline of Eli. Parak Gimel, so we said his vision was bad, and that's why Shmuel had to come very close to him. By now it seems like Eli is blind, right? So we have this decline in Eli, which is so symbolic. Now he can't see, right? Which also means two things. You know, he can't see literally what's in front of him and spiritually, right? As we talked about in Parak Gimel when he lost his prophecy. He just doesn't get what's going on. Okay. So the person from the battle tells him, he came from the battle. It sounds like, you know, he hesitates to bring the news to Eli. I mean, you can imagine, you know, what it's going to tell Eli. It's going to tell Eli, the battle was lost, thousands of the Jews were killed, your sons are dead, the Aron was taken, right? So it sounds like the man hesitates in terms of presenting the actual news. Pasuk Zayin, Vayomer Ishel Eli, Anochi Haba Min Amaracha, right? I am the one who came from the battle. Remember, he's the only one who made it, right? It's almost like he's stuttering, right? I ran away. I came from the battle today. And then he doesn't say anything else. So Eli says to him, my son, tell him what happened, right? We see a benevolent side to Eli, but, you know, the person on the side, what's he going to say? And then he pulls himself together, right? It sounds like he pulls himself together and he just lets out, right? It sounds like proclaims. Here is what happened. Nas Yisrael lefnei plishtim, right? Number one, we lost. We ran away. Gam magifa gedola hayisa ba'am. Casualty count, very high. Gam shnei vanecha mesu chafni u'pinchas. Your two children, Chafni and Pinchas, are dead. Ba'aron elokim nilkacha, right? And the Aron of Hashem was taken. Now, what's interesting is that you could read those as being said. I wonder which one is he giving these in order of worst to least worst or the opposite, right? I guess in a sense, the worst news is that they lost the battle. But the way that Eli clearly takes it, Eli is able to absorb losing the battle and he's able to absorb the casualties. He's able to absorb losing his sons. But says the pasuk, "Vahi kas kiro asaron elokim." It was the Aron that broke Eli, right? When he hears that the Aron has been captured, he falls backwards out of his chair. He breaks his neck because he was old. He was heavy. Then we're told that he led B'nai Israel for 40 years. Right? I mean, that picture of Eli as old, immobile, literally, right? His house is falling, right? This is the fall of Eli. And it's literally, Eli collapses. And the fact that it is the news of the Aron that sets him off, right? On the one hand, Rabag points this out, right? That's impressive. Rabag talks about Rov Chasiduso, how impressive, right? That he was so dedicated to the Mishkan and the Aron that was the thing that broke his heart and then broke his neck. But on the other hand, it really, really shows how backwards Eli's mentality was, right? That it was all about the physical object of the Aron and not about everything that the Aron represents. And it's possible that by Rashi, you know, having Shaul save the Luchos, so that might really drive this home even more, because then essentially, you know, if that's the case, so we have the part of the Aron that really matters, right? The Aron is just a golden box that Bezalel made in the desert. The Luchos are come from the Ribono Shel Olam, and that's the part that actually matters. So if you set up the story that the Luchos were saved and Eli is still destroyed by the loss of the Aron, so whether or not that's pshat, that just gets across the point that it was the physical Aron per se that Eli venerated the most, as opposed to what it actually represented and what it actually contained. So that is like a perfect coda to Eli the Kohen Gadol, right? He's dedicated. He leads for 40 years. He can be a benevolent person, but as a leader, he's a failure. And as a religious persona, he really just does not succeed. So the parak has four more psukim. Very, very interesting conclusion, right? The scene shifts from Eli to Eli's daughter-in-law, the wife of Pinchas, right? One of Eli's two sons who were killed on the battlefield. So the Navi tells us that Pinchas' wife was pregnant. And when she heard, I mean, you can imagine, she hears all of a sudden that the Aron was captured and her father-in-law has just died. And her husband is dead, and she's pregnant. So the shock brings her into labor, and she dies in childbirth. And the pasuk very, very clearly evokes memories of someone else, which is super interesting, right? She's dying in childbirth. The midwives tell her, "Do not fear, right? Ki ben yaladit." You're giving birth to a son, and then she calls the son Ikavod, right? Either meaning there is no glory or meaning where is the glory, right? She's devastated as she's dying, and she says this twice, right? That she's naming him Ikavod because of the loss of the Aron, right? She mentions her father-in-law and her husband, but her as well. This is the whole house of Eli. They are primarily devastated, not by the loss of people, but by the loss of the Aron. Okay. But of course, which person does this remind us of, right? Dying in childbirth, naming her child, giving her child a tragic name. Right, Rachel. Right, of course, right? This is Rachel Imenu. So, it's, I think, it's black and white. But here's what I think is so interesting about this. We've already seen Sefer Shmuel compare Rachel Imenu to someone else, right? We've seen Sefer Shmuel compare Rachel Imenu to Chana, right? And the birth of Shmuel to the birth of Yosef. So what the Navi is doing here, actually, this is super cool. You have this, right? We're taking the personality of Rachel and we're basically splitting her into two. And we're taking the wonderful moment, right, the birth of Yosef, and that's being associated with Chana. And we're taking the tragic moment, right, the birth of Binyamin, and that's being associated with Chafni and Pinchas and Eli, right? So that's like one thing which is really interesting. This is something that Tanakh will do. Like, for example, Megillas Esther, so this is like a whole long thing, but you think of Mordechai, right? Right? He let out a great, terrible cry. So that evokes Esav, right? And Chazal talk about this. But what Megillas Esther does is that it bifurcates Esav. There are a number of places in which Esav is compared to Haman. What does Esther do? The one moment in all of Esav's life where he comes across as a sympathetic figure, right? Where he's just in mourning because the bracha has been stolen from him. So we take all of Esav's bad, right? People bowing down to him and a murderer and someone who despises Vayivez, Esav Bechorah, all those are connected to Haman. The one human moment that Esav has, that the Megillah gives it to Mordechai, right? So that's something that's happening here as well, is Shmuel, right? We're consistently putting Chana and Shmuel and Eli and his children, right, on in opposition to each other. And we say, we take the personality of Rachel, and that gets bifurcated. And the Yosef moment, that's all Chana and Shmuel. And the Binyamin moment, that is all Eli and his children. But there's just one more piece beyond that as well. Because, right, when we think of Binyamin and the birth of Binyamin, was it purely tragedy? It was not. Rachel thought it was, right? Rachel names her son Ben-Oni. But then there's a follow-up, right? Yaakov changes the name, right? Yaakov names his child Binyamin. And the Ramban comments on this, that essentially Yaakov takes the same name and just changes a little bit, because Ben-Oni, so Rachel means it in the sense of mourning, but Yaakov takes it in terms of strength and then changes it to Yamin, but it's Oni can mean that as well. We'll have that in Reuben's bracha in Vayechi. So Binyamin himself can be bifurcated. And what's so interesting about Perek Dalet of Sefer Shmuel? Perek Dalet of Sefer Shmuel, not only are we holding up, you know, we have Yosef versus Binyamin, but the legacy of Binyamin himself is split in two, isn't it? Because who is the Ben-Oni aspect of Binyamin, right? It's this kid, it's Ikavod. But who is the Binyamin aspect of Binyamin in Perek Dalet? The Ish Binyamin, right? So Binyamin himself is bifurcated into two. So we're holding up Shmuel and Chana against the world of Eli, but we're also holding up Shaul potentially, right? Or Shevet Binyamin as well. That, you know, this whole world of Eli is a dead end, right? But there still is other hope. And by bringing in Rachel and Binyamin, right, that just, it sums it up like incredibly beautifully, right? So that's it for Eli, right? I mean, their whole worldview, right? It's just our own, Mishkan, and nothing that actually matters inside of it. And that ultimately is a dead end, right? And we're going to move on, and you know, it's going to be Shaul and Shmuel who are going to have to get the people out. But just to spend a few minutes at the close, when we think about, you know, as we say goodbye to Eli, so much later on in Jewish history, Eli really comes full circle. I think this is something that's really, really fascinating. At the end of the day, what was Eli's problem? Or the house of Eli's problem? They were obsessed with, you know, the institution of the kahuna and the mishkan and the aron, right? The physical element of it all. And nothing about, you know, Shmir HaMitzvos and Tefillah and Gimel HaSadim, right? Everything that the Abbas and the Imam stood for. So that is exactly the message that Yirmiyahu HaNavi has in the famous Parag Zion of Sefer Yirmiyahu. You know, talk about why this matters so much in a minute. But just as far as the message goes in this parag, right? This is the parag where Yirmiyahu walks into the Beis HaMikdash, right? And he says, you know, do not believe the false prophets who say, Heichal Hashem, Heichal Hashem, Heichal Hashem, Heim, right? All these people who say, look, we don't need to worry about the Babylonians because we're immune, right? Hashem is not going to destroy the Beis HaMikdash. The Beis HaMikdash will protect us. Exactly the same mentality, right? That carrying the Aron. Oh, the Aron came to the battle, right? We're saved. You fast forward a number of years, in a minute we'll talk about how many number of years later, Yirmiyahu is fighting the exact same mentality. It's not the Beis HaMikdash. Right? I don't care about the Beis HaMikdash. I do, obviously, says Hashem. But what really matters is, are you treating your fellow with justice? Ger yasom v'amana lo sashoku, etc., 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 right? As opposed to the Bnei Eli, right, who are eating karbanos while, you know, while stiffing the vulnerable. Same exact old story. And then what does Yirmiyahu say at the end? And he says, "What? You know, is this Mikdash Haganov? Is you steal and you come to the Beis Hamikdash? Hamaros Pritzim Hayabaya says that, right? Is the Beis Hamikdash supposed to be a den of bandits?" Which, you know, essentially is what Shiloh was, right? Shiloh was a den of bandits. The bandits in Shiloh were the Kohanim. And says Yirmiyahu, right? If you think that you can walk into the Beis Hamikdash in Yerushalayim and bring a karban and then do whatever you want, says Yirmiyahu, go to Shiloh. Yirmiyahu says it. Go to Shiloh, right? Look at the ruins in Shiloh. This is one of the places in Tanakh where it's clear that it was destroyed. We used to be the Mishkan, right? Hashem used to be in Shiloh. We saw after Shmuel's Nevuah, Hashem reveals himself. The Shechina is in Shiloh, and it left. Mipnei Ra'as Ami Yisrael, right? So Jeremiah says this is exactly what happened in Shiloh, where they were just obsessed with the Aron and the Mishkan and being a Kohen and none of the actual responsibilities of the Torah, right? And that led to the destruction of Shiloh, and it's going to lead to the destruction of Yerushalayim. Asis Levayas Asher Kodakrat Shmi Alav Asher Atem Botchim Bo. I'm going to make this Beis Hamikdash, this place that you guys have your security in, right? You don't have bitachon in Ribono Shalom. You have bitachon in the Beis Hamikdash. I'm going to make it just like I did to Shiloh. Says Yirmiyahu, right? I'm just going to bring it all back. The stories that you didn't learn your lessons from then, and that's exactly what's going to happen now. And then he concludes, stop with the karbanos, right? You're stuffing yourselves. You know, instead of bringing an ola to me, which you burn on the Mizbeach, you might as well eat it, because Hashem is finding it disgusting, because what matters is your behavior. All the same. Okay. Now, that's kind of depressing, right? Because, you know, like, it's exactly what happened to Shiloh, you know? So we had a very long time to learn our lesson, and we didn't. So, you know, that's a downer. Number of downers. But what's so interesting, and here's maybe the inspiring part of it, is who is Yirmiyahu? First pasuk we're told about Yirmiyahu is that he came from the town of Anasos, right? Which is in the land of Eretz Binyamin. Why is that interesting? Well, it turns out that that in Sefer Malachim, Eviatar, who is the descendant of Eli, who is fired as Kohen Gadol, fulfilling the prophecy of the banishment of Eli's house, Shlomo fires Eviatar, the descendant of Eli. And where does Eviatar go? He goes to Anasos, which means that it is very likely that Yirmiyahu, who is a Kohen from Anasos, is a descendant of the house of Eli. Right? Which makes a lot of sense, because we never see Yirmiyahu serving in the Beis Hamikdash. Right? He gives Nevuah in the Beis Hamikdash. We never see Yirmiyahu, you know, with Beit HaKahuna acting like a Kohen. If Yirmiyahu is a descendant of Eli, right, the banished family of the Kohanim, that makes a ton of sense. But then what that also means is that things are coming full circle, that B'nai Yisrael lapse into the same exact sins that characterized Eli and his household in Sefer Shmuel. But this time, it is a descendant of Eli who is the Navi who Hashem sends to try to turn them around, right? Yirmiyahu is the perfect kapara for Eli. And I forget who pointed this out. It might have been Rav Bazak on the BBM or someone else. But there are a couple of just really incredible mathematical pieces. Number one, it seems like this is the first prophecy that Yirmiyahu gives to B'nai Yisrael. You can imagine that's quite a way to start, right? You know, you've never done it before, and you have to walk into the Beis Hamikdash and tell everyone that that, you know, you guys all have faith in the Beis Hamikdash, but it's going to be destroyed. But what that means, a couple of things. First of all, Yirmiyahu prophesies. If you do all the math, right, the Navi says he begins to prophesy in the 13th year of Yoshio's reign. You do all the math, Yoshio, Yoachaz, Yoyakin, basically we have 40 years of documented prophecy from Yirmiyahu, 40 and a half, okay? So 40 and a couple of months. So that's the same tenure that Eli had, right? We said daily judge Bnei Yisrael for 40 years. So if Yirmiyahu, we think of, you know, as the kapara for Eli, the descendant of Eli, the kapara for Eli. Eli was at the beginning of, you know, the history of the Beis HaMikdash, basically, and Yirmiyahu is at the end. Same tenure. And one last point, I just think it's cool, the Beis HaMikdash is around for 410 years, right? So I double checked my math on this. I'm pretty sure I'm correct. You subtract 410 from 40 and a half, right? And you get 368.5, basically 369. This was not my idea. I forget whose idea it was. I apologize. So it means that Yirmiyahu is giving this prophecy about the coming destruction of Beis HaMikdash and referencing the destruction of Shiloh in the 369th year that the Beis HaMikdash is around, right? Because, you know, he's got it's his first prophecy, and we've got another 40 years to go. So it's the 369th year that the Beis HaMikdash is around. What does the Gemara in Zvachim say? How long do the Mishkan and Shiloh last? Says the Gemara, the Shtayr l'Shiloh, you do the math, says the Gemara, and the Mishkan and Shiloh is around for Shalosh Meos, B'Shivim Chasarachas. The Mishkan and Shiloh was around for 369 years, right? So it is in the year 369 of the Beis HaMikdash that Yirmiyahu comes and says to everyone, you know, you think that this Mikdash will last forever, but you are repeating the exact same sins and failures of the generation of Eli, right? Except now, instead of a descendant, a member of the house of Eli being the one causing the problem, right? Yirmiyahu is the one now who's trying to turn it around. So you know, that is the end of Eli, right? The fall of Eli, the rise of Binyamin, the coming hope from Shaul. So as we look back, ultimately there is a piece of redemption for Beis Eli. So that's it for Eli. Next week we'll move on to Parakim Hanvav. I think next week we're going to try to cover pretty quickly.